little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Menten. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
Well, I'm going to give our listeners, Julia, a little teaser about what we're up to on this episode, and then you can actually fill them in with the topics that we're going to be engaged in. And the little teaser is this. It's in the form of a riddle, which is a question. What has been said to be both the wick in the candle of learning, as well as very dangerous to cats?
That's a tough one, Bob. I'm curious to find out what the answer is.
All right. Well, what are we up to?
Well, I will introduce our topics for this episode, which include the nature of curiosity. See, I saw what you're doing there, Bob. The relationship of curiosity to self-awareness and consciousness, the role of curiosity in critical thinking, personality traits and other correlations with curiosity, conspiratorial thinking and curiosity, how search engines and social media exploit our curiosity, and a variety of other topics that you too might be curious about.
And our guest for this episode is neuroscientist Professor Jacqueline Gottlieb, currently the principal investigator at Columbia University's Zuckerman Institute, where she's also a member of the Kavli Institute for Neuroscience. And she's the former head of the research cluster on curiosity at Columbia University's Center for Science and Society. And her educational foundation includes a bachelor's degree in cognitive neuroscience from MIT and a PhD in neurobiology from Yale University. And her research career has resulted in numerous professional publications and a number of awards, including the Fellows Award for Research Excellence and the McKnight Scholar Award. And her research is guided by her curiosity about how the brain gathers the evidence that it needs during everyday tasks while ignoring what it doesn't need, and her specific interest in exploring the nature, mechanisms, and societal implications of curiosity brings her to be our guest. Professor Gottlieb, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you for having me. Very nice to be here.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. A lovely topic that we love revisiting every so often and really looking forward to your perspective. As we get going, maybe you could give us an overview of how your career path led to you having a research focus on curiosity.
Yeah, so that path was actually fairly roundabout and unexpected in my career. I came to neuroscience because I wanted to understand how we work, how we think, you know, how we reason, how we know things. I was interested in cognitive questions, and I was always attracted to studying eye movements and attention. You know, there's that old saying that the eyes are the windows to the soul. It really seemed to me that the eyes are just incredible indicators to what somebody's thinking about. And so I started my PhD thesis, and then in postdoctoral work, I was studying really nuts and bolts mechanisms of eye movements. So things like, how does a photon that hits your eye, how does it transverse and affect neurons in the brain until it gets transformed to a twitch of the muscle to move your eye towards that photon? But in the process of this, I learned that there is a stage in the brain that selects stimuli for eye movements. And those neurons, they live in what we call higher level areas, frontal and parietal areas. These neurons have this magical property in that they seem to know what to pay attention to. So in other words, they seem to know what is interesting. When you give them a super complex environment like we experience in everyday life, it turns out that these neurons do not actually respond to most things that should activate them in the environment. So they have this magical capacity of ignoring most things, but selecting very precisely things that are worthy of attention. And I realized that that was a very big puzzle in neuroscience. Nobody was asking what exactly is it that makes these neurons wake up and decide that something is interesting. I searched far and wide for an answer, a theoretical answer or an experimental answer. And my search led me really pretty far afield from traditional neuroscience, and I started talking to people that look at curiosity, because after all, when you select something to look at, you do it in the hope of learning something. You don't get a reward, you don't get a drop of juice, you don't get money directly for looking at something. What you get is information. So it became clear that my question is, in essence, what makes us interested, what makes us curious. It seems to be almost the same question.
There was a Q&A article with you in Neuron last year, 2023. You talked about the philosophical questions that have inspired your research. It's no secret, I'm a former philosophy major. I'm a bit biased in that way. So I'm kind of curious if you could give us examples of how philosophy has inspired your research. I think a lot of people don't see the correlation between sciences like neuroscience and philosophical questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many correlations. For my work in particular, the most relevant thing is thoughts about epistemology. And so, because I'm interested in how do we decide to value information, I have to think about what is information. And that leads to really startling realizations that information is counterintuitive. I recently just had a class with graduate students in Columbia, and I just asked them the simple question, what is information? That turned out to be harder than one would think. And they said something like data or observations or other things. So these responses all relate to things that come from the outside environment, right? So in general, we think of information as something, you know, we open our eyes and it's out there. Information comes from the environment in. But it's really interesting that in any theoretical framework, and also in philosophy, information really comes from the inside out. Information starts when you have a question, a source of uncertainty. For example, do you want to know if it will rain or shine? And you're uncertain in the beginning. You think they're equally likely. That is a question. And then a forecast becomes information for you because it answers your question. But if you didn't have that question, if you didn't care about the weather, let's say, you may not notice a forecast. I mean, how often do you look, for example, at your iPhone and look straight at your AccuWeather map and don't even see it, don't even notice that it's there? So information is not only about what comes in from the environment, but about the questions that we pose and the signals that we seek out, that we actively seek. And then the questions that we pose are in turn functions of what we can do, what our affordances are, right? Can we do something about the rain? It's a very fundamental level. So I learned most from, you know, Karl Popper, who shows you how you can think about affordances. Even a simple molecule in an organism is an affordance. So for example, if you have a molecule that senses light, if let's say you're just a simple bacteria, one cell organism, and you have a molecule that senses light, then light becomes information for you, and you will swim towards the light and seek out the light because you have a tool for using the light. You can sense the light and then convert it into energy and so on. If you don't have that molecule, light is absolutely nothing. You don't even sense it. You cannot use it. In a broader sense of physics, information is a reduction of entropy. So the opposite of disorder. Any ordered pattern is a type of information. And so living beings are ordered patterns until they die and they disintegrate into higher entropy. But while they're alive, they have lower entropy. And so it's really interesting to think, do we receive information? Do we generate information? Are we, in fact, information?
We could make our entire thinking clearly on just that question, what is information? And it seems like each field takes that little bit of information that they want to explore and defines it in their terms. It could be defined as the amount of uncertainty as well as the amount of entropy in a situation. That's great because starting out with the philosophy, lots of times people just ignore that completely. My original career was in the sciences in chemistry. And if I had it all to do over again, my undergraduate would be a double major in physics and philosophy. They form the foundation of anything else that we actually could learn or think about. So hats off to philosophy. But let's now start by unpacking curiosity with your description about the general nature of curiosity, and then dive into some of the details of what makes curiosity unique.
So, okay, I will speak as a neuroscientist. Neuroscientists and psychologists, cognitive psychology, started some 200 years ago when people started to think about, you know, mental operations and how the brain may process information and do elementary things. Of course, very quickly, people who were thinking about that realized that things are very complicated when it comes to brain and behavior. And so, of course, to study this, the tendency is to simplify it in some way. And historically, there have been two major ways of simplifying the system. One big strategy was taken by a camp that we can call cognitivists. And these people thought about mental processes, things like attention, memory, mental representations, things like that. And they devised tasks to study these cognitive operations in very precise and reproducible and sophisticated ways. So now we know how to study different aspects of memory, like encoding or retrieval. We know that we have different kinds of memory, different memory systems. We map them on the brain. The same for attention. We can study really very fast shift of attention. We can measure eye movements and so on and so forth. The other side of the neuroscience and psychology world talked about desires, wants and desires. So, and maybe a best known figure that galvanized this field was B.F. Skinner in the early 1900s. And he came from a point of view that all this talk about mental functions and mental operations, it's maybe a little bit suspect because we are imputing all kinds of internal functions that we cannot observe to animals. And instead he said, well, look, I can take a rat and put it in a cage and make the conditions such that I can tell you exactly what that rat will do. I'm going to make it hungry and give it a lever to press for food. And then I can tell you, I can build models with mathematical precision about when the rat will go to food, how much he will press, how much effort he'll do, and so on and so forth. And so this is all about observable behavior. And I can get really far without imputing any mental operations to that rat, just postulating that it wants something and it's reducing the drive and it's willing to exert some effort in exchange for a reward. And that spun another big wave of research on what we call decision-making and motivated behavior and mathematical models, and it relates to economic models and decision theories and so on. So these fields have evolved, and they're very much alive to this very day in neuroscience. There are people who talk about memory and attention and mental representations, and they know very little about decision-making, cost-benefit trade-offs, and so on. People who talk about decision-making know very little about memory and attention and other functions, by and large. I'm talking, of course, there are exceptions, but I'm talking about the majority. And students are educated in one of these fields. And the issue about curiosity, what's so special about it, is that it's exactly at the intersection of those two camps. And that's also why it took so long for neuroscience to start studying it. I mean, really, this wave of research on curiosity is only maybe 10, is less than 20 years old, maybe 10 years old or so. When I started thinking about it, there was barely anybody in my circle talking about it. But now I see like an incredibly fast rise in interest. But anyway, it's because it was right in the middle. It was lost literally lost in the cracks between these two camps. So in order to talk about curiosity, you have to talk about it's a motivated behavior. You want something. You're willing to exert effort to obtain something. But that something you want is not like a pellet of food, like the rat. It's not something external that can be measured precisely and doled out by an experimenter. It is something more elusive, like information or knowledge. It's some property about your internal state, really. So you want to think about something, you want to learn something, you want your brain to be in a particular state. And that's a very interesting kind of beast. So that, to my mind, that's what makes it so, curiosity so special, because I really do think it is the gap that we have to fill in order to progress in neuroscience. Those two camps that I talked about, the cognitivists and the behaviorists, they made tremendous progress within their own domains, and they gave us a lot of tools that are very useful. But at the same time, there's not a lot of room to go further, much further, unless you start closing the gap.
And that makes a lot of sense, because I've heard you talk and read some of your papers about the importance of interdisciplinary nature of studying things like consciousness. And it makes a lot of sense in that's the problem with specialists and being very specialized. It's like trying to understand a human being and thinking of a human being as a house. And you're looking in different windows, you're getting little pieces of the puzzle, but that interdisciplinary collaboration is so important, because you find out that they're studying the same thing that I'm studying, except using different words for it. So it helps people understand and be more philosophically pure about what their concepts are by collaborating interdisciplinarily. And you anticipated my question and answered it, which was going to be, can we view curiosity as a classical drive reduction framework like hunger? You know, for example, we need food. Well, can we just say about curiosity, when we need information, a negative tension is created, and then when we satisfy the need, that drive is reduced and we're back into a state of homeostasis or equilibrium or relaxation? And I think you answered that, because it seems like you're saying that, yes, sometimes curiosity operates like that, but there are other times that we can explain that in that simple kind of drive reduction framework.
Yeah. I mean, the drive reduction framework is a very general framework. I mean, in the its essence is the foundation of motivated behavior. You have a need, you take an action, and you satisfy the need. And that need is satisfied for the moment, right, until something else arises. That's almost by definition has to be true about curiosity as well. The difference, though, I think, is in what generates the need. So if you talk about food, for example, we can say, well, at the simplest level, it's generated by physiological mechanisms, by hunger that are innate and fairly non-plastic, not under our control. Of course, we can all imagine that you can have cognitive influences over feeding, but at the first level, you know, babies are born and they can be hungry. They know how to be hungry. It's fairly innate. The thing about curiosity is that what satisfies the need is your own knowledge structure, which grows all the time, right? And so that's a very different thing, right? I mean, it's a hugely plastic, hugely much less observable, much more difficult to observe as an experimentalist, for example. So I can't take a blood sample and know how much information you need. I might be able to take a blood sample and know how much glucose you need at a given point. Also, information grows. So, you know, hunger, you're hungry and you need a certain amount of calories. And when you satisfy that, you're done. But information grows infinitely. So in a sense, the way that our knowledge is built, knowledge generates additional knowledge. So it never stops. If you learn something today from what I'm saying, you will not say, okay, that's it, I'm done with curiosity. I know everything there is to know about curiosity. On the contrary, what you have learned today may generate more questions that you didn't even know to ask. So I may tell you today about some new brain area that you never knew existed, right? So before you heard about that, you couldn't ask the question. You didn't need information. But now that I told you about that brain area, you might go and research it. You might go look it up. You all of a sudden have new questions. And so, yeah, so in that sense, the need for information or knowledge is quite different from a very simple, innate, stereotype physiological need.
A few episodes back, our guest, Anil Seth, professor of cognitive and computational neuroscience at the University of Sussex, was talking about the nature of human consciousness. In your view, what does curiosity imply about self-awareness and consciousness?
Oh, that's something that I like to speculate on, but it is speculation since I don't do studies of consciousness. One thing that we think is important for consciousness is self-awareness. So it's almost like something, you know, like we have a self within a self, like we have a brain that does things, and then we have another little brain that looks on what the first brain does and can say something or report something, you know, so I can say, you know, there's part of my brain that may feel cold or may feel hungry. And then another part that can say, I feel cold, I feel hungry, right? So it's kind of an internal readout of my state. And curiosity is exactly that. So when I say I'm interested in something, when I have a question, I say, I don't know. It is exactly that. So there's part of my brain that senses information, represents information, retrieves it from memory, does all kinds of things on it. And a lot of that is unconscious or subconscious. But at the same time, I have the capacity of sensing some properties of all that neural machinery and reporting on it. And what I'm reporting is, I don't know. What is it, right? You know, I'm asking a question about it. Or I say, oh, I know that. That's trivial. I know it. I mean, that's, you know, that's boring. I can say that too, or I'm super confident about this. So it's that self-awareness. So simply asking a question is a measure of self-awareness that to me seems very closely related to consciousness. And in fact, I mean, I often wonder if consciousness didn't really evolve for that purpose, in order for different individuals to be able to share their state of certainty or uncertainty about something. Because a super important aspect of humans is that we are very social animals, and what we do in society is exchange information with each other. And I think this is part of the reason why we're so incredibly successful as species, because every single individual has limitation, has biases, has mistakes. They only see a part of reality. But by sharing information with each other, you really become tremendously more powerful. Anyway, but in order to share information with each other, we have to communicate these states of mind, and really important states are uncertainty. What is it I don't know? Or what is it I am confident about and you're less confident about? And so I think that this ability to self-monitor your epistemic states and communicate them with each other is really very important. And I would think it can play key role in driving consciousness. So yes, I'd be interested to talk to someone like Anil Seth and see how he thinks about it.
He's one of the interdisciplinary folks that ought to be in on any kind of collaboration, for sure.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Thank you for sharing your tentative idea about what consciousness is. That gave me a rush of thoughts when you talked about that, because you talked about sharing the possibility that one evolutionary advantage of the development of consciousness, which is a real open question, why did we evolve to be conscious? One explanation of that would be that since we're social animals, we have the ability to share that. And then that piques our curiosity to then think about that other position or, you know, point of view that never entered our head before. And then creates, as you say, a whole host of other questions. Where my mind went with that, and I don't want to get off on that tangent, is, boy, do we have now with the internet and social media, do we have a potential for sharing a host of very, very, very divergent views of the world? And and that also has a downside to it too, and that interplay. And we get into that quite often on this show, but I don't want to get off on that tangent. But I do want to relate this back to critical thinking, because we try to do that on Thinking Clearly. And specifically to that part of our description of critical thinking that reads like this: critical thinking is best complemented by having a mindset of genuine curiosity when examining and communicating our ideas, a willingness to acknowledge and evaluate evidence that may be contrary to our conclusions, and an openness to considering alternative conclusions and beliefs. I emphasized the genuine curiosity, which for me is different than, I'm curious about how I can win this argument. What additional information do I have to make a point? With me, the genuine curiosity is, it's really a subjective state, and I can't explain what it feels like, but it feels playful. It's a sense of wonderment. It's really focused on, I really want to know the truth of the matter, even if it contradicts my previous beliefs. So do you think that kind of thing that I describe as genuine curiosity, do you think that might act as an antidote to our human nemesis, confirmation bias?
Yes, absolutely, I do. I would just qualify this a bit. And again, we get to philosophy here. We have to become a bit philosophical. If you are really careful, you will realize that knowing the truth is not something that's exactly possible. Again, Popper goes into big treatise on it, but can we ever prove anything? Can we ever prove a hypothesis and so on? And so Popper concludes, together with other philosophers, that no, what the only thing that we can actually do is eliminate wrong hypotheses, right? Which is exactly a process of reducing uncertainty. So if you have 10 possibilities, you've eliminated one, now you have only 9 possibilities, you're a little more certain, you're a little less uncertain, right? The same way that if you have 2 possibilities and you eliminate one, you're even more certain. But we have to keep in mind that knowledge and information are really infinite. And because we are finite agents, we don't really know the truth. So I know this shocks people every time I tell them. I mean, you know, we know, like, we think we know some things, you know, we think that the earth revolves around the sun. And we really, I mean, it sounds crazy for me to say that there's a degree of uncertainty even about that. Right. There is a degree of uncertainty even about that, if you are really thorough and a good philosopher.
And a good Bayesian.
In a good Bayesian.
Yes.
You have to acknowledge that there's a degree of uncertainty. I mean, I totally agree with what you say, except I wouldn't, you know, when you say, I really want to know the truth of the matter. Well, I want to be a little more closer to the truth. Just want to get a little closer to the truth. Another thing is that confirmation bias, you know, it has a bad, so here you give it a bad rap in this sentence. But the truth is that confirmation bias is necessary for us to think. Again, because the space of information is infinite, and because we are finite agents, we have to know how to search. What do we search? We even have to know which questions to ask. And how do we know which questions to ask? Well, it goes back to what I was saying before. It builds on previous knowledge. If you know something about the brain, you can ask more questions about the brain. The more you know about the brain, the more questions you can ask about the brain. But let's say, you know, there's some being out there, some entity out there that's called a Zork. You don't know that that thing exists, and so you cannot ask questions about it, right? So you're losing information. The point being that when we search in this vast open space of all the possible knowledge, we have to be guided by our previous knowledge, which is a form of confirmation bias, right? We cannot right? We cannot see all the alternatives at once. We search, right? So confirmation bias is absolutely necessary. And so what can we do, right? So then you try to juxtapose curiosity in the sense of, well, now I'm going to be open-minded and I'm going to really entertain something that's outside of my regular way of thinking. So yes, we can do that. It takes effort, and it's really good to do that as much as you can. But at the same time, we have to be aware that nobody can be perfectly open-minded, because that presupposes, you know, infinite capacity. And so we're all subject to some confirmation bias, right? So I think it's more like striving to be open-mindedness. That's what I would call curiosity. Be as open-minded as possible, you know, experience a bit discomfort, expose yourself to some ideas that make you feel uncomfortable or new or even, you know, arousing because they're so new and surprising.
So what are the best ways to assess or measure a person's degree of curiosity? I mean, certainly one can be a little curious or a lot curious. And have these been used to do correlative studies? For example, does willingness to be a lifelong learner positively correlate with curiosity?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So that's a question we actually have a paper in press that deals with this topic. So as I mentioned before, in my field of cognitive science and neuroscience, curiosity is a relative newcomer. So what we're doing is we're inventing methods of studying it in the lab. And the way we do it is we bring somebody in the lab and actually give them a question, expose them to some sort of question or source of uncertainty. And then we ask, do you want to resolve it or would you rather pass? Do you want to pay to get the answer? Do you want to wait a little longer to get the answer? Do you want the answer to this or to that? So we try to do these very structured situations. So that's our way in our field. Before we came on the scene with these kind of tasks, curiosity was studied in the field of personality psychology. And that field defines curiosity as a trait, as a personality trait, and it uses personality questionnaires. There's right now a consolidated personality questionnaire that's, I think, the most up-to-date one. It's called the five-dimensional curiosity scale. And it has several subscales, some of which I'm blanking on right now, but I know that one of them includes stress tolerance. And another one includes social curiosity, because social curiosity is such a powerful drive that it's almost a scale in itself. So self-assessment questionnaires, and these are tendencies, they measure tendencies of an individual to have a particular attitude over long time frames, right? So your personality stays with you. It doesn't change so much from day to day. You may feel less curious now than you were 3 hours ago, but on average, what these personality scales measure is some longer term trend. And so in this study that we did, we actually tried to correlate some personality measures that are picked up by personality questionnaires and some behaviors in those small little tasks that we devise in the lab. And it's interesting that the biggest correspondence that we found is in the subscale of stress tolerance, which is why it sticks in my mind. So I think that what we pick up in the laboratory is a person's reactions to uncertainty. Like, what do you do when you're faced with uncertainty? And uncertainty poses some difficulties. So first of all, it's a bit more cognitively demanding. You need to acquire information to resolve the uncertainty or to answer the question. It's a very fine line between uncertainty and stress. Sometimes uncertainty is pleasantly arousing, as in, oh, I'm bored. I'm so happy to be able to, you know, have a bit of stress of working on this puzzle. That's good. But if the stress becomes too much, if you start being worried, for example, that you're not good enough, that you're going to make mistakes, that you can't solve it, then it becomes stressful and it can quickly turn unpleasant. And so we find that the scale of stress tolerance really maps with many behaviors that we pick up in the lab. Other scales, I think there are other scales related to aesthetic preference, They strangely don't correlate so much. There's another personality scale called openness to experience that also didn't correlate very much. And I think that that's also interesting because it points to something that we don't have in the lab right now, which is sort of naturalistic and organic knowledge. So when people test, when you report, I'm curious in my natural life on a personality questionnaire, you think about real situations in which you engage with real life knowledge, rich knowledge. You know, you're curious about books, you're curious about museums, you're curious about other people, you're curious to travel to other countries. I mean, very rich experience, the tap into your own memories, into your autobiographical memories, into your experiences, and so on and so forth. And I think that's a very important domain, but we don't capture it in the lab. So, in the lab, we try to keep things very simple. And it's interesting. I mean, I think it will be really interesting to see how to incorporate some of that more richer knowledge into neuroscience research.
So it sounds like this paper that you're talking about is almost like a validation study of some of these dimensions in this five-dimensional test.
I think in personality psychology, they're fairly sophisticated in validating their questionnaires. They validated them against each other.
Uh-huh.
Against each other, against, it's a one questionnaire A versus questionnaire B. You know, do they pick up the same thing or are they distinct? What if you change the question a little bit? Does it make a huge difference? You know, there's the various measures that they have. They're pretty robust, but they're all related to self-report questionnaires, right? And so we're bringing in a totally different methodology.
This is a general question, but I've often wondered about this in regards to critical thinking. We advocate so strongly for critical thinking, but I don't know that there's a lot of evidence out there, longitudinal studies and ways of measuring critical thinking to see if there's a correlation between critical thinking and a successful life, however you define that. But I'm wondering, have there been any studies that have tried to look at curiosity and maybe life satisfaction or anything like that?
There are studies and there is evidence that curiosity correlates with good outcomes. One that comes to mind, I think there's evidence that curiosity correlates with less domestic violence, for example. But, I'm not the best person to talk to. I can recommend personality psychology. I don't want to misrepresent the field.
Yes.
I think there are studies, and there also are studies, there is an interesting distinction, which I know is controversial, between curiosity and interest and long-term interest. The distinction being that curiosity is a bit of a fleeting emotion. So, you know, you can be like really curious. Let's say you go, this story of a bunch of tourists who go to see the northern lights in Norway, the Aurora Borealis, and they wait and they're like dying to see it. It's just, I want to see it. You know, they're dying of curiosity. And then they see it, and then that's it. They forget about it. Next day, they just go home. That's it. We're done here, right?
Right.
So we all experience things like this, as opposed to a lifelong interest that you build, right? So as opposed to, for example, building a hobby of, you know, learning about cars or learning about airplanes or learning about birds or learning language or something, which requires sustained effort over time and requires self-generated, self-regulated learning. You decide which questions to ask. You decide how much to investigate. You decide, what to read and where to go and what to do based on that, right? Self-driven. And I think that there is something to that. I think that interest can be triggered by this momentary curiosity, but I think that sustaining it is a much more complex process, right? Because again, it requires a continuity of thinking. You're like actively building your own knowledge structure, right? And the distinction is, important in education in particular, right? So for example, for teachers, it seems a good idea to be cognizant that what you want is not necessarily to make your students curious in the sense that they're excited all the time about various stuff. Your goal should be to develop in them the capacity to build an interest and to self-direct their learning on a longer time scale.
Very good. Yeah. And I do want to remind listeners that we are discussing topics related to the human trait of curiosity with our guest, Professor Jacqueline Gottlieb from Columbia University, where she's the principal investigator at the Zuckerman Institute and also a member of the Kavli Institute for Neuroscience. We had Leslie Ballion on. He is a Harvard University professor of computer science and applied mathematics, and he was a previous guest on Thinking Clearly, and he wrote a book titled The Importance of Being Educable, A New Theory of Human Uniqueness. And Jackie, you just got done talking about the role of curiosity in education and teaching. And he makes the case in that book that because humans can learn, we have the capacity to learn, we have the capacity to apply our knowledge, and we have the capacity to be taught by others. That is probably number one explanation of how we've been able to build the civilizations that we have. And also, and these are his words, have the power and potential to set our planet on a steady course. The Socratic method of asking good questions has been a key part to teaching for a long time, since Socrates and probably before. How does curiosity and the role of previous knowledge and uncertainty relate to teaching any course, and especially maybe teaching people to be critical thinkers?
Well, so the Socratic method of asking good questions. So, you know, if you think about it, curiosity is really quite a complex process. And I think the key ingredients in it are previous knowledge and a type of effort or arousal. Let's start with previous knowledge. As I mentioned before, previous knowledge, it sounds a bit like a contradiction, right? When you ask a question, it's in a sense a statement that you don't know something. But actually, if you think about it, it's a statement that you know quite a bit, because you had to know to ask the question. Again, if you don't know that there is such a thing as a brain, you cannot ask questions about the brain. If you don't know that there's such a thing as a neuron, you cannot ask questions about a neuron. I mean, you know, the Greek philosopher Socrates, as amazing as he was, and I'm sure he was smarter than most people living today, he couldn't ask questions about neurons because he didn't know that neurons existed, or about DNA or what have you, right? At one point you ask about messages to teachers. I would tell teachers that actually imparting top-down knowledge to students is really quite important. You cannot just let students discover everything by themselves. And then on the other side, there are the questions. So what is the point of asking a question? The point of asking a question is, well, first of all, to identify a gap in the knowledge, something to be thought about. But the other point is also to generate a level of arousal. So again, signals of uncertainty in the brain are related to physiological arousal. So we think that actually uncertainty is mediated by an increase in norepinephrine or some sort of arousing chemical. And why is that important? It's because information processing is really quite effortful. So you need to mobilize energy in order to learn, in order to retrieve memories so that you can identify a question and you can maybe try to answer the question from inside your brain, or in order to seek information from the outside. All of these are effortful processes. And then you need to generate plasticity to encode whatever you learned back into memory. So uncertainty, I think asking questions has the psychological effect of kind of waking you up a little bit, creating that bit of arousal that you need to work better. So, yeah, so that's why I think you need the previous knowledge, and then you need to wake awake it up by asking questions.
It makes me think of infants and young children. We always think of them as being curious, and then, of course, we think of adults have lost their curiosity along the way somewhere. But I do have twin grandchildren, and it's amazing watching them because what they're doing, it seems like, is they're building the basic categories that exist in the world out there, the basic framework. And what it seems that you're saying is that we can't ask questions or be curious about something that we don't have a conception of, a category. So something called curiosity must be a drive to initially explore the world well enough so that we can build that framework, which then opens the door to new questions and new categories and new refinements of the old categories that we learned. So thinking about curiosity that way, in my mind, shows how complicated that whole process is and how difficult it is to study, to define, to measure in the lab or measure with assessment devices. That seems to be a basic part of what you're trying to get across to us here and across to our listeners. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I wanted to say about children, one thing that, you know, you often hear that children are so much more curious and then adults lose their curiosity. And I am someone who always likes to look for the counter evidence whenever I hear these claims, especially claims that are repeated so often and they sound so true and obvious. Yeah. And I remember a book, I wish I could remember the name of the author. I just read about the book. But anyway, the claim is that, in fact, a child cognitive psychologist who said, actually, if you look at the things that children want to learn. So yes, indeed, children learn a lot of things because they don't know. But they are concerned with what is possible, what is real, what is possible, what can I do, right? They just want to master reality. So then you become an adult and you have mastered reality. So you no longer ask questions about everything. But as an adult, you actually become more creative because you start thinking about, oh, what is it that we don't think is possible and I could make possible? Like in scientific research or when you invent a new rocket to fly into space. So the case that I think was made in that book is that you really need adult levels of knowledge to have really curiosity with capital C, like major level curiosity and creativity that actually transforms, goes way beyond what is generally known. But kids don't do that. Kids just want to know, you know, how can I do what mom and dad do? That's it. They don't want to do the impossible. They just want to do what they see modeled in front of them.
And then I'll just quickly add that students want to know, is it going to be on the test?
Exactly.
And then when you're working in your career, you want to know, what do I need to know to do my job better and, you know, make more money? And then I'm a retired guy. So when you're retired, you get to actually explore and be curious about the things that you really want to know, whether or not they really have any value in terms of monetary or career advancement or anything like that. So, yeah, I agree. I agree with you that it's a myth that we lose our curiosity as we get older.
Yeah, it's a myth. And we're touching on another thing that I think is super important about curiosity, and that is agency and self-generated question. I mean, maybe that's one of the most important things about curiosity. Because we all, in a sense, answer questions all the time, right? When we do our job, when we just solve little problems all the time. The difference is that when we are actually curious, we generate the problems, we generate the questions, right? And so it's a much more self-driven process than simply asking externally posed questions. So I think agency is another one of these important things about curiosity that has philosophical implications and all kinds of implications, not studied a lot, as far as I know. It's on my list to learn more about.
To shift gears a little bit, a topic that seems to become quite ubiquitous these days, and something that's really just in most of our lives is internet-based applications like social media is something I think a lot of folks spend a lot of time on these days. But also, you know, search engines, like the word Google has become a verb and a noun. You know, so these are things that are really ubiquitous in most of our lives, social media, search engines, various portals that the internet offers us in capturing our attention. And so I'm interested in how these things, like social media, exploit our curiosity in order to capture our attention.
I really do think we live through a revolution of the information age with digital information. I mean, in a sense, it's similar to the invention of the printing press. That was also a revolution when people could communicate with each other much more than was ever possible through the written word, through written words and images. And now it's become even more. And it's not just that we are subject to a deluge of information. We are made to be subject to a deluge of information. The moment you open your eyes, you're subject to much more information than your brain can process, right? So when it comes to information, it's like we're faced with infinity no matter what. So whether the internet comes on top of that infinity, you know, it doesn't matter very much. The thing about the internet, though, is it's a very specific kind of information because it's generated by other human beings, and we are masters at drawing each other's attention because we are evolved to communicate with each other. So that information, it's much more potent psychologically in terms of capturing attention, like you said. And also, it is different from information that we have organically. You know, imagine the information that you deal with as you sit right now in front of your computer, or as you go later and make a cup of tea, or as you interact with your friend or colleague or spouse. That is embodied information. It's multisensory. And a lot of it is processed unconsciously. I mean, think about how much you need to know to hold a cup of tea. I mean, it's just mind-boggling that your mind somehow, your brain somehow does this. And that's information processing, but it's not verbalizable, most of it, non-verbalizable information. When you interact with social agents in person, you also process a lot of information which is not verbal, not declarative. And you are moderated by the physical presence of that person, right? First of all, that person is within the reach of your body, and so they can hurt you. And so the incentive, like we never think about this, but the incentives to be nice and cooperate go way up simply because, you know, because you're close to each other and that person can reach you. And so I think that that's, you know, with in-person communication builds a lot more trust, carries a lot more information because it's much more than just talking. We communicate through verbal cues, we communicate through intonation, a million signals that we give. That's the way we naturally learn to communicate. Now, translate that to the internet. The signal that we get to the internet is much, much more impoverished. We just have words, right? Somebody writes words in India, and I see those words like thousands of miles away, out of context. I don't know that person. They probably mean something. They haven't been able to express into words exactly what they mean. Then I read the same thing and I understand completely different. I mean, that whole transmission chain is, whoa, incredibly buggy, incredibly prone to faults. And it's also a very small part of what that person is, what that person can convey or intended to convey. At the same time, when those words arrive on my computer screen, they can create an immediacy as if I was there, an immediacy that compels me to act, right? So let's say I read about, you know, some children who were killed in some part of the world because, I don't know, a dam burst or something. I'm compelled to act. I feel like, my God, I should be doing something. I should be sending money or going there or helping children or whatever. But of course we can't, right? So that's another thing. We're broken. We keep having this sense of arousal and all kinds of feelings being stirred up, but ultimately they can't go anywhere, those feelings. There's nothing we can do. So it's a lot of uncontrollable information. It's not useful the way natural information is to us. So I think that processing information over the internet is really very, very difficult, different psychological process. It doesn't build the trust and the cooperation that happens during normal communication. It's very impoverished. And also it has this thing of uncontrollability. And so I'm not surprised to see that it's associated with rise of all kinds of anxiety disorders. And I think that we will take a while. I think that this, again, it's relatively new phenomenon. I mean, I think we will need to learn about. I'm sure we will learn how to cope. I mean, we learn how to cope with books, and this is analogous to books, I think. But, you know, I mean, I think we need to educate children. I do think that social media, hopefully it would lose its novelty so much, and then kids won't be so into it all the time because it's old hat, and that will have some protective effects.
I'm glad that we're ending on an optimistic note because that's a big problem, and we talk a lot about that on Thinking Clearly. Well, it seems like Julia and I at least know enough about curiosity to ask a whole bunch of questions because we have many more questions to ask, but we're at the end of our time with you. So, Jackie Gottlieb, I want to thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and taking your time to help us and our listeners satisfy our curiosity about curiosity, and for helping our listeners understand and appreciate that wonderful and invaluable human trait. So, on our Facebook page, we're going to post your lab's website at Columbia University, as well as the website there at the Zuckerman Institute, and your research profile on ResearchGate. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
No, that's it. My lab website isn't entirely up to date, but I guess you can post it. Yeah, I just don't have time to update it.
And a big shout out to our listeners. Thanks so much for your support. And as always, thank you, Julia, for over 8 years of collaboration and friendship in doing this labor of love that we call Thinking Clearly. And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.